Okay, so we're talking about homework, about the rasterizer, okay? So I was explaining here that one of the key things about perspective is that things that are farther away are smaller, right? And things that are close, nearby, are bigger. This happens because projecting, if this is the camera, you know, the observer point, there is a frustum. We're looking in this direction, and we're seeing everything within this cone, right? There is a plane, you know, which is like right in front of the camera, okay? And it could be any plane, you know, it's just a matter of scale. And what we see on the screen is the projection of anything that the camera sees on that plane. So just imagine that there is a floor, right? And there is marks on that floor at regular intervals, right? What happens is any interval that is nearby, you know, is going to end up bigger on the screen, right, than an interval that's far away. And that's because of this projection. In a way, it's kind of like this angle is bigger than this one. This projection is bigger than this one. So it is basically this z value, distance to the camera, you know, that's affecting everything. If you were to have a wall that's vertical here with some marks at regular intervals within that wall, those will also be at regular intervals on the screen. Okay? It's just the difference in Z, the difference in distance. Now,
in one case it's changing, in one case it's not. So with the wall, the Z is not changing between the regular intervals.
Exactly. It's the same Z for all of them. So we need to use this Z in order to correct. The perspective correction, I don't know, how many of you got the textures working and interpolated? You know, 2, 3, 4, 5 or so. And you saw that distortion, right? Along the crease, it kind of bends, depending on the angle. So when, say, a side of the cube is flat, facing the camera, you know, it looks perfect. But as it turns away, it distorts. And that, it's because it's becoming horizontal. It's having a bigger range of Z values on it. Okay. Now, this Z in camera space, okay, gets transformed through projection into the W of clip space. Remember that? So Z gets transposed into the W, and Z is repurposed for the Z buffer. And could have been different, and, you know, the other way around or whatever, but, you know, that's historically the way everybody has done it. Okay? So it's the W in clip space, in the homogeneous space, that is used to correct for perspective. Now, imagine that we have this triangle here. Okay? This is the triangle as it is in the real world, okay? And then we're going to look at it from different angles, you know, from different perspectives, right? So if you do linear interpolation, it's the same as, you know, if you're looking at it dead on, right? Because this would be all the same. When you're looking at it from some angle, okay, if you linearly interpolate from that point of view, what you get is a distorted set of interpolated attributes within the triangle. What ends up happening is, if I'm looking at it from this side, and I linearly interpolate, you know, I don't see, you know, a series of marks along this line, that are same distance with each other, when I look at them from this angle, okay, I would see them with equal distance on the screen, even though this one is further away and this one is closer by. Okay. In reality, what I want to see is something like this. You know, I look at it from this point of view, ends up being more, you know, this is that triangle, but from this point of view, you know, it's narrower, right? Because I'm looking at it more from the side. So, what I'm supposed to see is the same markings, okay, are closer together when they're closer to this point, and then they get further apart, right? Something like that, okay? What this means is I'm still getting values from within this triangle, okay? The set of values that I get is the same as with linear interpolation. They're just in a different place within the triangle, okay? So, in order to correct for perspective, what we need to do is find an alternate set of barycentric coordinates that work. That basically correct for that. And we need to use the W in order to do that. The way to do it is to pretend that we have, you know, 1 over W values on all the vertices, okay, which we do, right? So if we're interpolating, say, on this point over here, okay, if we linearly interpolate those, we'll get another 1 over W over here. What we do is, you know, you have, like, say, I, J, and K, right, for bicentric coordinates. So you just multiply them and add them together, and you get a new 1 over W, which is interpolated on this point. And I, J, and K are the bicentric coordinates of this point. If you do that, say this is 1 over W sub I, just because it's interpolated, okay? What you need to do is just get those barycentric coordinates adjusted by dividing them by this interpolated value here, okay? So what you're doing is, you know, multiplying a 1 over W and dividing another 1 over W. Okay, so you're basically adjusting. You know, you're still getting the same type of attribute, whatever it is. Same thing for the other ones. Okay. And you use those as new barycentric coordinates for this point, which basically are barycentric coordinates of some other point. In this case, it'll probably be barycentric coordinates of this point, say. Because I'm looking at it from this side, you know, it's going to pull it towards me.
Dividing 1 over WJ by 1 over W capital Y gives you
A new bicentric coordinate, which is adjusted. You know, this is, you know, with this, what we're doing is just, you know, adjusting the bicentric coordinate. Anyway, go ahead and, you know, try it once you get, you know, that interpolation working correctly. You know, if you can interpolate anything, you can interpolate everything. You just need to do it, right? You know, every single value within the pixel is interpolatable. And they're all independently interpolatable. You know, they're just values. And they have no relationship to each other.
And to get the 1 over W capital Y, you're just finding the regular barycentric coordinates and computing that from the 1 over W at each of the vertices. You're interpolating the 1 over W's to get the new 1 over W. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
So then the colors,
yeah,
also need to be perspective corrected.
Yeah.
I tried that. Well, whitewashing.
Whitewashing? That's because your interpolation was not good enough. I mean,
the same interpolation for the texture coordinates.
And that. Well. One thing with the colors, what did I use for colors there? The 3DX color?
Yeah.
Which is still for floats. So that should be fine. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes colors in graphics, you know, they get represented by 4 bytes, right? Because, you know, 256 levels, you know, between black and white, you know, seem to be good enough for the eye, mostly. But you know, that can distort math sometimes, you know, if you're not careful about it.
Actually, my photography teacher said something a little different.
Oh yeah, no, there's the whole thing about gamma correction and color profiles and all sorts of things that we can go into there. We'll go into some of the gamma correction stuff, because it is interesting, and it's become more interesting over time in like, you know, high profile games and all that stuff. Right?
More games?
In all like high profile games. I mean, not in Deer Hunter, but yes, in Halo. And in between, it depends, but
I think he was basically saying that, you know, a camera is linear in its values, whereas a human eye is more following the f-stops, where it's doubly.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Or logarithmic.
Yeah. 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 And that's why all the math that everybody has done in video games for many, many years is completely wrong. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you do with Z also barycentric?
Mm-hmm. The Z is special. The Z you should just linearly interpolate. Always. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, that's the way the Z buffer works.
But it won't do any harm if you
Well, okay, so let's say you have two meshes, right? And they're rendering and they intersect each other. Okay. Let's say, like, you know, there are two cubes. The intersection between the two cubes should be a straight line. You know, if you correct the Z values, then suddenly it will not be within triangles. So you'll get similar distortions to what you have without perspective correction on the textures, but you'll get that on the Z as they intersect. Again, you know, the values of all the attributes, including the Z and everything, on the vertices, you know, they're always correct. You know, on the vertices, they don't need to be perspective corrected of any kind, right? So, if your triangles are tiny, then doing perspective correction might be overkill, even. Mm-hmm. But if your triangles are big, then it becomes a big issue. That's why you will not see a difference in the teapot, you know, between perspective correction and not, because the triangles are kind of tiny. But in the cube, you do.
Even when you're grazing the side of the teapot, they're too small for perspective correction.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're looking, so when you're looking at the side of the teapot, kind of like grazing past it, the center.
Yeah.
That's where you'd have the maximum need for perspective correction.
Yeah, but the triangles are tiny. The difference in C is still going to be very small.
Very close together there.
Right.
All
mm-hmm.
the top.
Yeah. I mean, there's a point at which, you know, it just becomes part of the noise of, you know, the imprecision in calculations and floating point running errors and all sorts of things like that. Mm. So, and way before then, it becomes completely indistinguishable to anybody's eye. So, yeah, that was one way in the old days. That was one way in which we did perspective correction when there was no 3D hardware. You know, it's okay, so split the triangles. You know, if they need it, you know, split them more. If they don't need it, split them less. You know, that sort of thing. Yeah. So you calculate, like, you know, perspective correction, you know, a few points within the triangle and then interpolate it between those, which is interesting. Another way that I've seen is, you know, to use an approximation of the divisions by, you know, using a little parabola, which, you know, corrects somewhat, makes it so you have to split less. But anyway, you know, over the years that I've been doing this sort of thing, you know, everything has been cheated in one way or another. Absolutely everything. Just like that. Okay, just a show of hands. Who here got at least the basic part of the rasterizer working? A few that not quite yet. Okay. Yeah, so gotta get cranking on that. Just remember, you know, send it before the deadline, please, even if it's not finished. Much better that way. Any other questions about the rasterizer? Okay. All right. Oh, I need to turn this on. There. Okay, so it's time we started talking about shaders. Let's see, what's this? Good. It's time we started talking about shaders. So you guys remember the GPU pipeline and all the different stages that it goes through? I know that some people had, you know, I'm actually not sure exactly where that sort of thing came from. You know, many of you in the first homework turned off alpha blending in various ways, okay? Sometimes unsuccessfully. there's a render state called alpha blend enable. You know, you set it to false and it's gone, right? And that's the way. But people found, you know, various ways of making sure that the alphas were always set to 1, right? You know, with an alpha of 1, transparency doesn't happen, okay? One of them is in the texture stage state, right? Alpha op, you know, choose the argument 1, and then argument 1 is current, right? And then that makes sure that the alpha from the texture doesn't get used at all for anything, right? That was one way. And several of you did this. Again, I'm not sure where it comes from. You know, I think it's more of a lack of awareness of how to operate the different parts of the GPU. I kind of debated switching the homework for this week to more of a book search one. Basically give you a list of 200 states and you tell me which units it affects. That sort of thing. You know, I don't know. It would have been an interesting experiment. I've never done that. So, then again, I've never done the homework that we have for today. not as such. In the end, you know, I decided to kind of, you know, keep moving forward and hopefully things will percolate, you know, this type of information about, you know, what render states are best for use in what manner. In the end, you know, once you get into shaders, because shaders substitute a big part of what the older GPUs did. What it means is you have to manage a lot less state. There is, I mean, out of the renders, you know, the regular render states, probably only about 20% remain that do anything once you get to shaders. Maybe. The texture stage states, none of them do anything anymore. The sampler states all do some, you know, they still do their function. You know, those describe how the textures get sampled. You cannot specify that in the shader. So it's pretty much that, you know, about 20% of those and then all the 20% of render states and pretty much all the sampler states and that's almost it. Set transform, you know, world view and projection matrices, gone. Set light, gone. Set material, gone. So, in a way, you know, this simplifies our task a lot. You know, once we get into shaders, you know, it is your responsibility to decide what state you're going to have in your shader. Okay. But not in this week's homework, because I set it up for you. Not only that, you know, I didn't even give you the source code for the executable because I realized that I kind of had the solution to the homework in it. And it's, you know, the way I did it, you know, it's kind of, I couldn't extricate it. But don't worry, you'll get that too. So we have, in Directory 9, we have two types of shaders. In Directory 11, there are 6 type shaders. So, you know, it gets more complicated as you get with more modern hardware. But these two vertex and pixel shaders are the vast majority of anything. You know, even when you are thinking about Directory 11 and, you know, OpenGL 2 and all those things. This is the assembly view of shaders. Okay, this is what they look like. You should familiarize yourself a little bit with it, because when you are debugging shaders, which you can debug shaders, if you don't have everything right, you'll get this. You'll get the assembly of it. Okay. Whenever you see assembly, you always see a shader version number. This is kind of like the profile, but shaders have their own sort of versioning separate from Direct3D profiles. Remember I said, you know, there's 3.9, 9.1, 9.2, 9.3, there's 10, 10.1, and 11 in Direct3D. Okay. And that's for Direct3D as a whole. You know, the things that it supports, how many rendered targets, how many textures at the same time, things like that. The shader language has its own version, you know, 1.0, 1.1, 2.3, 1.3 and 1.4, you know, are like old versions. You know, back then, it was very simple. I mean, like 1.1, it was the very first one. It only allows you in the assembly to have 8 instructions total. Okay, so you can only do very simple stuff. Okay, now, those 8 instructions, each one of them can do as much as one of those texture stage states. You know, it's one of those texture stages, right? I mean, I say 8, but you know, if you do like color and alpha separate, then you can have 8 of each. You know, it's not tremendously simple. Another thing, for here, we're pretty much only going to be using, you know, 2.0. So this would be 2.0 like that one. Okay. On the assembly, they look different. In 1.1, it just says, oh, there's a texture. I'm going to call it T0. And there's nothing that you can say about, you know, how the texture is sampled. You know, that happens even before the code starts. So this T0 here is just the color that we got from the texture in the calculations. With 2.0, for instance, you know, you can explicitly say when and how to sample from textures, which is interesting when you want to calculate the coordinates in the shader. So you could have calculations up here that end up modifying this T0, which is the coordinates. Okay. These two shaders do exactly the same thing. this is exactly the same multiply and add of 3 parameters. So the different versions have all sorts of limitations. It's all in the documentation. You know, there are like some black holes in there where you don't know exactly what, you know, how things play together. It's not all completely and perfectly specified. You know, this was old stuff and it was pretty much defined by the hardware at the time. That's why there are so many 1.something versions of the Pixel Shader. Because, you know, it's like, oh, you know, we're creating the very basic one. And then NVIDIA said, oh, we added a couple of more features. So there you go. We made a new version. And then ATI said, oh, I'm adding a couple more features to that. You know, so we create another version and so on. We've stopped doing that, of course. So these are all the things that can change between profiles. You know, for 2.0 profile, pretty much all the stuff that we're going to do will fit within the shader model. Okay, so you should not have any problems. But it can happen. Last year, one of the students suddenly bumped into the limitations of the 2.0 and said, oh, can I start using 3.0? I'm like, sure. But just so you know, okay, it can happen. It's going to be rare if it does. That person was doing, like, you know, all sorts of crazy bump mapping and, you know, waves in the ocean and things like that. Execution time is one that's kind of interesting. Okay, so like the very first training models, you know, wouldn't even allow you to like do loops or conditionals or, you know, any kind of control flow. But the later ones, like 2.0 and 3.0, do allow that. You know, you can do loops and conditionals and all sorts of things like that. So once you have a loop, okay, you have a hazard. The hazard is called the infinite loop, right? Imagine that your shader is running forever, okay? Just because you made a mistake. Suddenly the GPU is clogged by that, okay? So, and that would be very bad because your computer stops working. You know, you cannot put anything on the screen anymore because the GPU is gone. You know, it's just busy trying to finish that loop that never ends, right? So they did put limitations on how many instructions one share will allow to execute before just giving up. So that you're aware, that kind of thing can happen. You know, the share just didn't even finish. And the only indication you have is, you know, whatever the share was supposed to do didn't get done. Right? And that's all. Well, if it was a pixel shader, the pixel never got rendered. If it was a vertex shader, none of the triangles that share that vertex ever got rendered. Okay. When programming shaders, we're going to use this HLSL. The assembly stuff is just for you to know, because this is a very tight, specific, small kind of architecture. You need to know the limitations. And if you ever get to see assembly in the debugger, then you need to know at least what it is. Okay? But we're going to use this. And this is awesome because we have structures and functions and all sorts of things. Okay? It's very much like C++. There are no pointers. Of course. There is no memory per se that your share is going to be using. You can use variables and also stuff, but it's all going to be in registers of one way or another. It's not memory. So you cannot have an infinite number of them, of course. You know, everything is limited. Amount of so-called memory and amount of so-called registers and so on. And there is no object-oriented anything. I mean, you know, without pointers, you know, there is no point in that. But it does have some very interesting C++ features that we'll see as we go. So first, you know, just be aware of types. You know, there are some predefined types, like this sampler is a type. It's basically one of those set sampler state. Okay, what you put there ends up here. You have these float 2, float 3, float 4. You know, those are your single values or two-dimensional vectors, three-dimensional vectors, four-dimensional vectors. Similarly, you can have int 2, int 3, int 4, bool 2, bool 3, bool 4, you know, all of those. Okay? And that's so because, well, the shader engines are built with four-dimensional math in mind. Okay, so they do support up to four components per numeric type.
Are these single precision or double precision?
That's a very good question. They are single precision. There's actually been some fights between NVIDIA and ATI back in the day. You know, the day of the 2.0 and 3.0 shader models, because ATI did it actually in 24-bit floating point format internally. All the registers were 24-bit, which means, you know, shorter mantissa, okay? So rounding errors appear sooner than with 32-bit. You know, but it was pretty much okay. NVIDIA, on the other hand, you know, they decided to make the GPU so it's configurable. It could be either 16 or 32. Okay, and 32 floats, you know, 32-bit floating point values internally, okay, would mean that the GPU runs at half speed, but with more precision. Now, the problem is, the specification kind of says, you know, that doesn't quite specify, but if they tried using only 16-bit floats, you know, running errors would actually break games that were developed on ATI cards, right? So by default, they did that. You know, they say, hey, you know, 16, because that's how we're fast. But they ended up having to do very nasty hacks in the driver, like, oh, if you're running this game, then switch to 32 behind the scenes, so that the shader, you know, the shaders don't break apart and, you know, overflow errors happen and so on. So yeah, it is an interesting question in that sense.
Has anybody done 64?
Yeah, the shader model 5.0 specifies that 64-bit doubles are supported, I believe. And there are GPUs that do it, definitely. Which is kind of crazy, but hey. when you're not doing graphics, instead you're doing, like, you know, molecule folding and all that stuff, it kind of becomes useful to be able to do floats. So anyway, you also have user-defined types in the form of structures, just like in C. Okay. There's no type def or anything like that, and, you know, it's just, you know, the structure, and you use it like in C++. Okay. So that's as much as far as types. There's also, apart from floats, you know, there's something. Okay, so this float is four floating point values, X, Y, Z, and W. Okay. Another type that you can encounter is float 4x4, or x4, which is a 4x4 matrix. Basically, four of those four-dimensional vectors. Okay. And you can also find things like arrays and that sort of thing. Okay. Float and then array 4. That's kind of like a float 4. Although, you know, you can't use the same functions for it. It's a different type. One thing that has nothing to do with C++ is the semantics. So after defining a variable of some kind, you can put a colon and then a semantic. Okay. Semantics do not affect the program per se. What they affect is the linkage between the values in this particular shader and the rest of the computer. So Direct3D will use those things in order to figure out how to transport what you do in the C++ code, how to transport that into the shader. So for instance, this register S0 means that set sampler state with the first parameter of 0, okay, will affect this register. You could have more of them. Okay. In Direct3D9, this also corresponds to the set texture. So set sampler state and set texture have to have the same index corresponding to each other. This one's here, which are applied to the input into these pixel shader. Okay. What they indicate is where those values come from. Okay. The parameters of main. It indicates where they come from. Okay. In this case, this is a pixel shader, so they come from, where do the parameters of the pixel shader come from? Rasterizer. Okay. And they correspond very, very closely to the outputs of the vertex shader. Because the vertex shader outputs attributes, and then they get interpolated by the rasterizer with perspective correction. Okay, and the pixel shader gets the interpolated values. You know, but the layout of the structure is identical. Okay? So, wherever I see color 0 here, okay, will correspond to whatever, you know, the output of the vertex shader set color 0 for the semantic. You know, it provides the linkage between the two. So it's kind of important to keep them, you know, to keep track of those. Okay? They can have different names. The name has nothing to do with it. It's just the semantic. This other semantic over here is the output of the pixel shader. Mm-hmm. Because Direct3D9 supports writing at the same time into multiple render targets, which is sometimes very useful. Mm-hmm. So you could have multiple outputs, or an output structure with color 0, color 1, color 2, color 3. Mm-hmm. And those semantics indicate to which of the targets the colors go. You also have functions with return values. With in parameters, you can have out parameters. So you can return multiple values from a function. It's kind of like in C++ giving it a pointer so it can fill in, or a reference, so that the function can fill in the value. Only in here, it actually specifies in or in out if you're going to read and then write to it. Or out, if you're just going to write to it, if it's pure output. You can define your own functions, like the main function of your shader. You can have others, and you can call them. Okay. You just need to do whatever is natural when it comes to functions there. Okay. Just remember, no references, no pointers, just pure values everywhere. With model 2.0, all your functions will be inline. They must be able to be inline. No infinite recursion or anything like that. You know, the compilation will fail. There are also intrinsic functions, like this text2d. It's provided by Direct3D. It's not defined anywhere in the code. It's like a library function. There's a whole bunch of them, and they're all listed in the documentation. Just when, you know, nowadays all the documentation is completely mixed between Directory 9 and 10 and 11. So you just need to look. Is it supported in Directory 9 or not? You know, is it supported in Shader Model 4 or not? Shader Model 2 or not? Okay. In this case, this is the instruction that fetches from a texture. So I have texture coordinates as input, and I have a texture sampler that I've defined over here. And say, hey, you know, sample from this texture. And then this down here is a multiply add. This is exactly the same shader as we had in the first slide in Assembler. Exactly the same one. So you have to learn the language. These are common pitfalls. When you multiply, it's always per component. If you have two float 4x4s, which means two matrices, okay, and you multiply them, you're multiplying each component with the corresponding component of the other matrix. You're not doing what's called a matrix multiplication. Okay. Same thing with the vectors. When you multiply two vectors, you get another vector. And what you're doing is just multiplying them component by component. If you want to do vector multiplication or matrix multiplication, it's this intrinsic mole. And you have dot and cross product, and you have all sorts of intrinsic functions to help with vector-specific operations. Right? This one here is just a reminder of what I said. Compilation might fail if you blow the requirements of the underlying architecture. And there's no way to predict. You can make a shader and then you try to compile. If it compiles, then it means it fits within the specification.
Oh, is it compile time?
Yes. Nice thing about shaders is they're made so that they don't fail at runtime. Maybe they don't do what you thought they would do. Okay, but they don't fail per se. There's no exceptions. There's no crashes. There's no such things. They might just return incorrect values because the algorithm is wrong. So vertex declarations are kind of interesting. Okay, this is a substitute for the flexible vertex format. It is very highly recommended to use vertex declarations when you're using shaders. It is possible to just use flexible vertex formats like we've done, and it's perfectly okay to do that. The main shortcoming of the flexible vertex format is that it forces you to use a very specific and not very well-defined layout of your vertex structure. If you say it has position, normal, diffuse color, and two texture coordinates, they have to be in that order. You can't put the normal first and then the position. Another thing that can be done with the vertex declarations is to have multiple vertex buffers which are parallel to each other. So it's like having your vertex be a composite of two different structures, and then you put one structure in one vertex buffer and put the other structure in the other vertex buffer. They just provide, you know, a different set of, you know, two sets of inputs for the vertex shader and the GPU. This can be very useful sometimes for animation. One way to animate meshes is to have two frames of the entire mesh. Classical example is the dolphin. You know that. I'm sure D3D still has somewhere. You know, that's the canonical sample on the Xbox, so I know it very well. So it's this dolphin, okay? And there are two meshes. One of the dolphin kind of, you know, curved upwards, and the other one with the dolphin curved downwards. Okay. And the vertex shader gets both positions from both meshes and interpolates between them so that the dolphin does this, right? So you can have two meshes, you know, and wherever you have two meshes, you can have 20 frames of animation and then interpolate in between them. But you don't want to repeat all the texture coordinates. You don't want to repeat all the colors. You don't want to repeat anything but the positions themselves, typically. And maybe the normals. So you put the positions and normals in one vertex buffer. So you have 20 of them for all 20 frames. And then you have another vertex buffer, which is just the rest of attributes that do not change throughout the animation. And then you give the vertex, you know, you give the GPU three of them, two of the position buffers and one of the attributes. And then the shader will take both positions and interpolate. You know, you give it the interpolation factor. and we'll take the rest of the attributes from the other one, from the other buffer. So anyway, so these vertex declarations, again, you know what they do, and the only thing they do is tell the GPU how the data, how the vertices are laid out in memory. Because you usually lay them out in structures in C++ like this, but the GPU needs to know about the innards of that structure. So this vertex declaration is telling the GPU about this. First, for each one of these fields, it needs to provide where within the structure the field is. That's this offset off. That's a C++ standard macro that some of you might not know, but it is standard. And what it says is there is a type called vertex. Give me the offset in bytes of the field position in this case. Okay. Just how far from the beginning it is. In this case, this is going to be zero. But the nice thing about writing it like this is if you want to insert something in the middle of the structure, you can. You know, and this offset off will just calculate the correct offsets, no matter what's in between. Okay? Same thing for the normal. You know, it just gives the offset as normal. Because this is a D3DX vector 3, which is 12 bytes. This is going to be a 12. We've got hard-coded. We should prefer not to. Then we also need to provide the types. This is a vector 3, 3 floats. And this is how you do it. The 3 decal type, and then it's basically an enumeration, and you need to pick one of them. The 3D and the GPU do not understand every single type. You know, every possible type ever invented. You know, it's just a fixed set. Okay. So that's as far as how this structure is laid out. For each field, where it is, offsetted in bytes from the beginning of the structure. And then what type it is. The vertex declaration also provides a linkage with how the shader gets those values. In this case, there is a semantic of normal zero, which is in the input to the vertex shader. And this is how it's done. On this particular field, you do the D3D decal usage normal, and then a number, 0. There can be 0 to 15 of any of those. They're all given names. If you want to put a color in a normal semantic, you can do it. It's just numbers, right, that get transferred from one place to the other. They get transferred from memory, from the C++ world, into the GPU, into the shader. Okay? You can call them whatever you want within this enumeration. It is good to call the normals normal and to call the texture coordinates text chord. Okay? It's just good practice. Okay? But D3D and the GPU will just do whatever you tell it to. So this is the other type of linkage. You have a vertex shader output, which is color 0. Okay, that will link with the color 0 input on the pixel shader. If the pixel shader doesn't have a color 0 input, then the value gets dropped. But if the pixel shader has a color 0 and the vertex shader does not output it, then D3D will barf at you very, very strenuously. Okay? Basically, it will fail to draw because the shaders do not match. Okay, so you have to be careful about those. Any questions so far?
So all is that all inputs have to have an output, or
So basically, values can get dropped. Mm-hmm. So, say I have this vertex declaration, right? And say that I have a shader that does not take normals. That's fine. You know, the value is there, it just gets unused. Okay? So having a value and then not using it is okay. Not having a value and then using it is just not so good. Okay? Having a value and then not using it is wasteful in performance. And that's true for both. For the linkage between the structure and the vertex shader, and also for the linkage between the vertex shader and the pixel shader. And that's another reason to separate the vertices into two structures, into two vertex buffers. Sometimes. Because you're going to use the same vertex buffer, but sometimes you're going to ignore some of the fields. So you put them in a separate buffer. That helps with cache coherency, if that makes any sense to you. Yes.
Vertex shader a different hardware in it, or is the same hardware?
As the pixel shader?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good question. So, is the pixel shader unit the same as the vertex shader unit? In Shader Model 2.0, no. The limitations are different. In Shader Model 3.0, at least the answer was yes from the very beginning. Nowadays, all modern GPUs use the same execution units for vertex shading and for pixel shading. So it's exactly the same assembly language, exactly the same everything. On the Xbox One, the original Xbox, for instance, the pixel shader was not really a shader at all. It was just a kind of like the texture stage states, only with more bells and whistles. And that was at the level of the hardware. You know, it was just a bunch of registers. You know, you say, oh, and multiply. Oh, and this is your argument. Oh, and... But yeah, nowadays, it's exactly the same unit. And it makes sense because many games have been switching from using vertex shaders to using pixel shaders a lot. Because lighting is so much nicer, you know, the graphics quality is so much nicer when you do all your calculations per pixel instead of doing them per vertex and then interpolating, right? So it used to be that the pixel shader, you know, was just a simple unit that does almost nothing. But
so how is that done? You kind of translate the pixel back into ROM space and then calculate.
Okay. So that how to do the lighting calculations in the pixel shader? That's an interesting question. You can pass in the world coordinates from the vertex shader, which you have. You can pass in world coordinates as attributes, like anything else. Call it position one, semantic. You can just pass that in. And then, voila, you know, you have your interpolated position, which is a position in world space, in the pixel shader, for your pixel. And you can pass in the normal. One interesting thing about the normal is that when you linearly interpolate or perspective correct, which is, you know, warped linear interpolation, when you linearly interpolate two normals, normals are supposed to be normalized, right? Their magnitude should be one. But say I have a normal here and a normal here. Okay? If I linearly interpolate between those two normals, I'm going to get something that's going to be smaller. The ultimate case is when I have a normal in that direction and a normal in that direction. If I linearly interpolate between them, I get zeros. Okay? So, when we interpolate normals, we should renormalize afterwards. Okay. And yes, there is a normalized intrinsic. No, the rasterizer, yeah, the rasterizer interpolates. That's what it does. You know, it finds the pixels and interpolates the attributes. Once that's done, in the pixel shader, what you're getting is not normalized. The magnitude is less than one. So what I'm saying is when you get normals interpolated into the pixel shader, renormalize. In the olden days, the renormalization was done by sampling into a texture. Like you give it the coordinates and it gives you the coordinates, but, you know, instead of RGB, it gives you XYZ, but renormalized. In the olden days when there was not much math power in your shaders. Nowadays, with ShaderModel 2.0, you would never do that. It is wasteful. It's much, much faster to just calculate and renormalize.
Would it make sense to use, what do you call it, quaternions? Because those can be smoothly interpolated? Or is that... I do know something about quaternions, but
yeah. See, that's one part of the math review that we didn't quite get to. You know, I plan to revisit that. You know, I started kind of wanting to do it today, but I think there's more interesting stuff to do today first with the math that we already have. So we will finish that. You know, it ends with spherical harmonics. So we'll see about that, about interpolation and spherical linear interpolation and logarithmic space and all that stuff. So again, it's mostly used only for animation. You know, for something like this, the spherical linear interpolation that you can do on the quaternions, it's way too complex for pixel shader, you know, for it to be worth it. It's much, much easier and faster just to do this, renormalize. More questions? Nothing? Going once, going twice? Okay.
Is there documentation on this? Is it in the...
Yeah, documentation about shaders, you know, it is basically the reference of the HLSL language in the DSVD documentation. And that is actually quite complete. You know, its main sin, if you will, is that it's mixed everything all the way up to model 5.0. So you'll find things there and you say, oh, goody. And then, oh, I can't use it. So what can I say? Sorry. There's another thing that's also of interest in shaders, which is starting at the model 2.0. You can sample from textures arbitrarily whenever you like within your shader. Okay. There is older hardware where they put some limitations. Like, you can only sample at 4 points within your shader. You could sample multiple times, but only at four points during your shader.
Points at 4 different textures.
Hmm?
Points on 4 different textures.
No, it's basically a chain of 4 dependent fetches. So, okay, so dependent textures. You know, that's one thing that came about with Dirac-39 is the concept of you're going to read from a texture, get some values out of it. Remember, textures are colors, right? Well, wrong. Textures are values, which can be used as colors, and usually are. You can use them for whatever you want. You know, we'll talk about things like VRDFs when we talk about advanced lighting, and those are usually done as textures. And there's just a function that you put in a texture. So the texture is you give it 2 coordinates and you get 4 values back. You know, that's basically what it is. And it's a kind of represents a function or 4 functions on like 2 dimensions, right? Of 2 parameters. There are different kinds of textures. You know, there are also cube maps, for instance, which you can give it 3 coordinates. Or volume maps, which you also give them 3 coordinates. You know, the only difference is cube maps will actually normalize the coordinates into a normalized vector before sampling. And I had a point about this, but I forgot. Oh yeah, dependent textures. So you could, like, you know, just sample from a texture, get some values. Use those values, maybe calculate them somewhat, you know, just use them in operations, and the result from that, you sample a different texture. Okay, that second texture, it's, you know, where it is going to read depends on where the first, you know, what you got from the first texture. So it's a dependent read. Okay, so there were limits on how many dependent reads you could do within a shader. And those are not specified in the shader model, I don't think. But some hardware had the limitation. So it could do it, but only so far. Make sense? Kind of. Why would you ever want to do a dependent read? One reason is normal maps. You ever heard of normal maps?
Is it like bump mapping?
Normal maps.
Is it like bump
mapping? Yeah, it's like bump mapping. Basically, it's a texture that does not specify colors. It specifies, you know, how the surface is oriented as far as lighting is concerned. I mean, just imagine you have... Imagine you have the surface of a triangle. Okay, normally you have normals like this. If you do per pixel, right? You know, they would be kind of smooth like that. With normal mapping, you can instead of interpolate those normals, you can get them from a texture. So suddenly you have normals like this. If you want. Okay. What this looks like is it looks like instead of it being a flat triangle, it's basically has edging in it. Sorry. Oh.
Need more changes in
it. Yeah. So it's something like this. Kind of looks like that. You know, you can do things like, you know, put engravings in the face of a triangle, in the face of a mesh, without actually having to put vertices in it. And those engravings, you know, will reflect the light appropriately because the normals dictate how that happens. Okay. So if you fetch those normals from a texture, and then you use texture in order to calculate lighting, like, you know, this BRDF that I mentioned, that's a dependent texture. Now the reason is, once you have those normals, you can fetch from what's called an environment map. Environment map represents the light that comes into an object from all directions. You know, it's a cube map. You know, it's basically a texture map of directions from everywhere. I could make an environment map of this room, and it will have the ceiling and floor and all the walls. And if I do it from my point of view, it will have all of you in it. Okay. So then you can use those normals in order to calculate reflection vectors. And suddenly, you know, you have a mirror. You know, your mesh looks like a mirror. Looks like metal. Surface of the water.
When you said texture unit samples the data, right? So how does it sample? It has to do some kind of filtering.
Yeah, we haven't talked about textures yet. You know, we have one entire deck about them. You know, we're not getting into the finer details of textures yet. But yes, I mean, anything that goes into set sampler state specifies how to sample from the texture. And you've seen it, you know, point filtering or linear filtering. Addressing modes, wrap or clamp, you know, which, you know, you used in that, the conveyor belt thing, right? So, yes. Any other questions? Okay. I wanted to finish this first part by demonstrating two things. And let me actually do this as a copy. So I don't have to be craning my neck while I do this next part. Okay. So this is just the you know, the rasterizer homework, which I got just as an example. I probably should use the Bejeweled instead, but this will do for now. So the idea is I run this, and come on, it works fine, right? Well, this is all built on a software rasterizer, which means Direct3D has nothing to do with Direct3D has nothing to do with the Direct3D has nothing to do with the actual rendering of the scene, but then I use Direct3D in order to splat it on the window, right? So what I want to do is just break it so it stops working. Okay. And one way to do this would be to say, you know, I make a mistake. run it. Oops. Well, something kind of worked. A little bit. Okay, so I made a big mistake. The question is, how can I fix this? You know, what can I do? And this is something that I want you to start doing immediately. Okay? If you go to... Oh, stupid projector. It's just way, way too wide. Well, if you find the Direct3D June, in here you'll have a DirectX utilities. And in there, there is something called the DirectX control panel. Okay? You can go ahead and run that. And yeah, it'll say that it wants to do nasty things to the computer, which is okay, it's normal. And it has several tabs, one of them is Direct3D9. Okay. If your computer is 64 bits, and this is important, you'll have two of them. Two control panels. You know, there are two, there's a utilities folder in there, and there's a utilities 64-bit folder. You'll need to use the 32-bit one if your program is 32 bits. The control panel controls the applications of one type of CPU or the other. Okay? Your 64-bit computer can run them all, but they use different parts of the Windows registry. Once you have the correct one open, you'll see several different options that you can change how your computer is going to use Direct3D. The most important one is up here. Use retail version of Direct3D9 or use debug version of Direct3D9. The debug version has a lot of instrumentation built into it. It does exactly the same thing, but it checks parameters. And it checks multiple sets of states for consistency with each other. So when you make one of those mistakes, sometimes this can help you. Okay? So use the debug version of Direct3D9. There's this other checkbox here, which is break on Direct3D9 error. Okay, so when it detects an error, it will actually put a breakpoint in your program. Which means your program will crash if you're not running from Visual Studio. Right now I had it disabled because the Zune app in this computer triggers that. I don't know why. Okay. That you had that? Yeah. So, maximum validation, that sounds like a good idea no matter what. Enable shared debugging, yes please. Break on memory leaks, that's when your program closes, you know, it will hit a breakpoint, you know, if you have any memory that is allocated and not freed yet. If you don't have it checked, it still reports it, right? So that's usually good enough. Break on D39 error is useful because it breaks it right at the spot where D3D detects the error. Okay, so you can go ahead and know what it is exactly that broke. And then here you have the debug output level, you know, how much spew you're going to get from Direct3D. So let's turn everything up all the way. Let's see what this does. Oh, actually this is not going to cause it to break. Because... Poly. I'm running it. It's not fair. This is not fair. Why is it crashing now? Oh, I know. Well, I know why Visual Studio might be clogged. So if you turn on the maximum spew, okay, sometimes the game can be spewing faster than Visual Studio can get and display them in the output window. And that can cause Visual Studio to stop working, but the rest shouldn't. Okay. I guess we're going to pause and, we'll continue these after this break. How about that? So, let's do 10 minutes. Just so I can verify everything. So let's get back together at 25 minutes to 8. Okay. We're in business again. Ish. So, what I wanted to do here is to give you tips for debugging issues with Direct3D. Now that you're going to start for real. I mean, the Bejeweled thing, not a big deal, right? it was a simple kind of, rendering functions only. And the rasterizer was it was a software. It had nothing to do with Direct3D, per se. But this week's homework is about shaders and about working with shaders. So I want to give you a couple of weapons, because you're going to make mistakes, right? And it's kind of hard when you make mistakes and, he's 100 years, he went through that last year. So the idea here is, this is not like debugging C++. You put a breakpoint, you single step, you look at variables and so on. Okay. But we can get close to that, with shaders. The converse thing is that we can get close to that also for Direct3D itself, because we have all these pieces of state, right? And they have to match. The vertex declaration has to match the vertex shader. The vertex shader has to match the pixel shader, and so on and so forth. Okay. So this is basically how you get Direct3D to tell you when you make a mistake. So let's go for round two. And if it doesn't work, then I'm gonna scream because this has been working. Actually, that's a very good idea. Because don't need that. Put the control panel there so it's easy. Now that I've shown you. Okay, debug output level is in let's give it one notch in there. Hi. We're using debug with maximum validation. Okay. Here we go. Don't breathe. This is probably the wrong thing to do. Because we were not using shaders here. I'm going to have to just try to find a combination that's illegal. Okay. going to blow. Crap. Just try to find something that's legal. Okay, clearly my computer is just not working.
Maybe that combination froze it up.
Hmm?
Did that combination freeze it up?
Yep. Yep, when Control-Delete doesn't work, it's bad. Okay, so that's going to take 10 more minutes.
What is the expected outcome?
The expected outcome is you get a breakpoint. And I've gotten plenty of them. I don't know why I can't do it today. You get a breakpoint. Also, there's a whole bunch of spew. You know, the referee sometimes will just give you warnings and not break. But when it's an error, like, hey, you know, this state is not supported by the hardware, then it actually breaks in there. The other thing that I wanted to introduce you to is something called PICS. And I can talk about it a little bit, you know, while the computer boots. It's probably, it's not doing a check disk yet, so it's fast this time. Faster. So PICS is a performance tool that was created for Xbox. It's an acronym. It means Performance Investigator for Xbox. It was created on Xbox, and its main purpose was to capture everything that Direct3D did for one frame. The entire scene, the entire rendering of one front buffer. And it would capture everything. And then, you know, save it to a file, and then you could load that file up in the tool and start analyzing your frame. And it would give you lots of very, very cool things. Like every single draw call, you know, what it saw as the vertices, you know, all the data for the vertices. You know, the vertex shader, once it processed the vertices, what were the outputs of the vertex shader for every single draw call? For every single draw call, what state was active at that point? In the GPU, in Direct3D. You know, what was the alpha blending mode, for instance? And it also allowed you to say, hey, for these particular vertex of this draw call, just give me a spew of what the vertex shader did. And it'll give you, back then it was just assembler, right? Shader, like we saw in that first slide. And it would give you all the instructions that it executed, the vertex shader, and all the values of the inputs, the values of the outputs from that instruction. So you could follow how the calculations threaded throughout the shader. Same thing for the pixel shader. And it would show you all the configuration of that pixel shader that it had and so on. This was all in the original Xbox, right? And it would also give you another kind of capture, which is timing. So it would time when the CPU executes one of the draw calls in Direct3D. And then it also record when the GPU starts that draw and when it finished. So you could see, you know, the performance on both the CPU and the GPU and relate them to each other and so on. It was really, really cool. The tool was very specific to the Xbox because it's just one GPU, the GPU of the Xbox, with one implementation of Direct3D, the Direct3D that we made for Xbox. So we had access to everything, absolutely everything, and we could control everything. Then somebody said, hey, you know what, why don't we do this for Windows, for Direct3D? And they said, awesome, but you can't do everything in Windows, okay? You can't because an NVIDIA GPU that's recent, for instance, is very different from an ATI GPU of 3 years ago. It's just very, very, very different, okay? So what they did for Windows was something slightly different. I'm about to show you here. So, again, just forgive the silly projector, and hopefully you can see enough. So you have in the DirectX SDK, June 2010, you have DirectX Utilities, and in there you have Pix for Windows. If your computer is 64-bit, this will only be in the 64-bit, I think. It's only in one of them. Basically, the same tool works for 32-bit and 64-bit apps. I'm going to just make sure that it fits within the projector. Just so that we can all see everything. So this is the best way to use this tool. Basically, one session, you know, they call it experiments, right? So you just say new experiment, okay? And then you need to from last year. You need to find the executable that you want to look into. So I have mine in here. And this is this week's homework. Stupid. Without the executable. Ugh, silly me. Actually, screw this. I'll just download it. Just because I'm cool. Three homework, shaders, this, open, allow. This is all you're getting. Wait, not this. Just replace everything. I don't care. Okay. Pix. So you select the executable in Pix. Okay? We're going to run that executable. And, I mean, you can play with all of this as much as you want. But this is the one that you use for debugging. The one that says... single frame capture, whenever F12 is pressed. Okay. And then you need to go to more options, target program, and you might need to just set up the startup folder. Okay. Bleep by default uses the folder of the executable. When you, in your game projects, for instance, that's usually not what you want. So just put whatever startup folder your game wants to run in. That's going to find all the textures and models and everything. And then you just start the experiment. When you start the experiment, and if this fails, I'm going to scream. Okay, this is the homework. It's ugly. You can switch to reference. You know, that's kind of what it needs to look like. And you're the one who needs to make it look like that. Look it like that. So, and you'll see that it has, at the top left, you know, it has a frame counter and some data like that. You know, it's just Pixis monitoring this program as it runs.
So
okay.
Is that Pix rather than your program?
Huh?
That text is Pix, not your program.
Exactly. That text is Pix. So the idea is that you can press F12, and it will take a second, but it will capture one entire frame. It captures that frame. I'm going to capture that one, and I'm going to capture this one. Okay. There you go. And then I can just exit. And Pix will, you know, show me this view. Okay, this view has a timeline up top, which right now I don't care. And here you can see the two frames that it captured, here and here. Okay. And here it has a view of objects like textures and vertex buffers and so on. Objects that are live, dead. It keeps track of which ones have been released and stuff like that. I've never really used those two views much, to be honest. This is where the action is. Okay. In here you can see the same corresponding thing of the timeline. You know, there are basically two frames that got captured. Okay. And this number here is number of event. You know, thing that it captured about the frame. So it captured about 1,090 different things within the first frame. Oh no, I captured more. Okay. Okay. So here you can see what Pix saw, and Pix sees everything that you do with Direct3D, and also with Direct3DX. Okay, so you will see Direct3DX calls in here. Those will be kind of like a tree, so you can open them up and see what it did to call Direct3D under the hood. Like if you use Direct3DX Mesh for Tiny in the game project, it will show up here as a Direct3D Mesh call. Okay. So here it says, you know, begin scene and then set sampler state, set render state, set pixel shader, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, here it says set pixel shader, and it's just got a number, okay? So you can't do much with that. This is a quirk of Pix. You need to switch on the right side to the, basically to one of those two tabs, render or mesh. Usually just use render, okay? If you do that, suddenly those become links, okay? basically what happens is Direct3D has executed all of these commands up to this point. And then it shows here what the render target contains at that point. Okay, so you can see every draw call, how it adds. You can use these two, like D up and D down. You know, that D means draw call. Okay, so that's basically find the previous draw call or the next draw call from where you are. So I can go and say, oh, find the next draw call. There you go. This draw call rendered the ground. There is no cube, there is no anything. That's just the first draw call. Okay? So I can see what the render target contained, which is pretty nice. In the mesh, I can actually see what the mesh looked like. Okay. This is before the vertex shader. You know, it's just like an orthographic projection, you know, of the vertices as they entered the vertex shader. This is after the vertex shader. Mm-hmm. And this is what it looks like on the screen. You know, you see this. This is the rectangle of the render target. So this is where it ends up. Mm-hmm. And down here, you have vertex shader values before and after. Mm-hmm. So this is all the inputs to the vertex shader of the position, diffuse, specular, normal, and texture coordinates. Mm-hmm. And then after the vertex shader, I have position, diffuse, specular, fog, and texture coordinates. Mm-hmm. What it uses is the semantics.
And the primitives would be whatever you put in. Primitives. The primitives on the left column would be triangles or whatever you're referring to.
Yeah, the primitives, basically, for its triangle, it gives you three vertices, you know, with what indices they had. It's kind of hard with these low resolution things. So, you know, this is one triangle. You know, indices 0, 1, and 2. And then 3, 4, and 5, and so on and so forth. Okay?
So you can see the index is the same for P1, 4, and...
Yeah, this is the vertex index, so this will be basically increasing. These are the indices. So index 0, 101, 102, 0, 102, and 1, and so on and so forth. Okay.
What coordinates space are the vertices in?
At this point? Okay. So at this point, the positions are in clip space. So this position is after applying the projection matrix. This is what you get. Okay. Projection space. So you then. Yeah, that's that happens after dividing by W. So this is precisely what you get out of the projection matrix, which is clip space. Actually, it's not. It's projection space. You know, clipping will be done after.
And the fourth position is W.
Well, the fourth position is W, yes. So in here you have the X, Y, Z, and W. Okay. This W will divide all of those. And that will give us normalized, you know, negative 1 to 1 for the X and Y, and 0 to 1 for the Z.
And then in previous it would be world coordinates?
Previous, yeah. No, that will be model coordinates, local coordinates. Source coordinates. It's what's in memory in your vertex, in the vertex buffer. I mean, in this case, this is the ground, and the matrix is, you know, the world matrix is identity. So, yes, world coordinates. Yeah, you have those. The vertices themselves only have three coordinates. You know, the fourth one, you know, is added. The vertex shader can get a float 4 when you only have a float 3 in your vertices. Okay, and it'll just add 1. Okay, so this is one place where you can go looking for interesting stuff. Another place you can go looking for interesting stuff is this. Oh, I have Vertex 0 here. I want to debug it. And this is then what happens. Sheesh. Actually, I think that's last year's. Oh my goodness. Thanks. Okay. Let's do this again. That. More options, target. Start. F12. I'm going to save it just in case I don't have to run again. I'm going to reduce this. I'm going to try it with these. Render. Yep. Okay. So the theory goes, this will debug a vertex. Allow you to debug the vertex shader. Okay. The other one, which we'll see if it works, is this. Debug this pixel. You right click anywhere in the image, and you can debug any particular pixel that you want. Ah, okay. What that gives you is a list of all the different draw calls that somehow intersected that pixel. In this case, we're in 987, so, and that's this one. And the pixel shader output was this color, which is green. And it didn't get rendered because it was too far away anyway. But, come on. Nah. Okay. I should reinstall fresh and it probably work better. Just reopening it, but so that's the kind of tools that you have. On the left side, actually I can open this yet again. So in here, when I have all these little links over here, I can also take a look at the shaders. Like this pixel shader, I can double click on it. It'll actually give me, this is basically the disassembly. This is a stub that I put in. You know, it just outputs screen. In assembly, and also the source. Okay. When the shaders get compiled with debug info, okay, then PIX can find the source and do all the correlations and the debugger when it works. And I have to apologize for that, but you know, this is tricky stuff to get it, to get this working. Yeah, that's what he's doing. Basically, I render the ground green and then the other stuff magenta. And you do have the source code, okay? The stubs. So at least you can look at it here. Say, oh, you know, which pixel shader was I using? I set it here. There, okay. You can also look at the vertex declaration, okay? So you can try to troubleshoot things. Like, oh, you know, this is not supposed to be tangent, supposed to be something else or whatever. And the vertex shader. And the vertex shader is a more complex one. There's also a source. And this is what I've given you. You know, it only has some of this stuff implemented so that it actually looks like what it's supposed to look. You know, it does the matrix multiplication to output the correct vertices and so on. Okay? And the other thing that's interesting is when you double click on the left side, which is the device, you know, the device where the set vertex shader was called, you get this, and this is a huge amount of information, okay? You have general device information, you know, what the back buffer width and height was, what the back buffer format, and, you know, the Z buffer, and stuff like that, and then you have these other tabs like input state. Now the index buffer is null at this point. The indices were being set down here. So if I get the device at this point, there is an index buffer. Okay. And then all the different vertex buffers, you know, which is, are called streams here in DFV 9. And, you know, tessellation state, who cares? You're not going to use that ever. Vertex state. Vertex declaration, you can find it here. The clip planes that D3D has set. The vertex shader that it has set. Constant registers. And, you know, this thing goes down a lot. Let me just readjust the size of this thing. So there is a lot of stuff in here just because there are lots of values that you can pass to the shader. Okay, most of them constants. Same thing with the pixel shader. You have clipping, you have kind of clockwise calling of triangles. System rectangle, which is, you know, the region of a target where we're rendering. That's very useful when you have like split screen games and things like that. Then rasterizer state, and alpha testing, fog configuration, point sprites, and so on. Texture palette, basically the textures that you have set. The sampler states, so what your filtering is and all that stuff. Anyway, you get all of the data about all the state. You get it all over here. Okay, output state is going to be, you know, the render target, you know, the dev stencil, sorry. What type of z-buffering test is being done, stencil, which we haven't talked about yet, blending, okay, which is opaque right now, you know, gamma correction and things like that.
In input state, you said there was like 16 vertex buffers. So
yeah.
Like one could be in position.
Exactly. You could have an array of positions and an array of normals, an array of texture coordinates. Yes. But they all have to be the same length. Okay. Or if they're not the same length, actually I'm not sure about this. Maybe D3D will complain if you give it buffers with different length. If it doesn't complain, then at the very least, all the indices that you're going to use, or all the vertices that you're going to use, have to be in all of them. Okay, so even if your vertex shader is crashing, okay, this can be invaluable right here. Only available at draw calls. There you go. This thing can be invaluable. Just being able to see what the inputs and outputs were, so you can figure out where the problem was. Okay. The only thing this doesn't give you is introspection to what happened in the middle of the shader. To be honest, probably the crash is driver related. Because Direct3D has to kind of trust the driver to do the right things. And even though it's doing the capture and getting all this information mostly at the API layer, Direct3D9, the driver infrastructure was kind of awkward for D3D to do all this stuff.
So for the shaders, with this, we can kind of see what input came in, the code that was run, and the output. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
But we can't step through it or something like
that. Well, in my desktop computer, stepping works fine. I did try last night, but I have to admit, I used my desktop computer, not this one. Hence all the issues. So it is a little bit touch and go. Yeah, basically, once you get into the debugger, okay, right. The debugger, what it does is because the execution of one single vertex is a very short thing, it actually grabs the entire thing. So you can go forwards and backwards and like the single stepping and so on. And it'll give you the values of the registers. If you're doing source debugging, it'll give you the values of all the variables that you have at any particular time. And yes, you can step into functions, not the intrinsics, of course, but your own functions. You can do all those things. It's kind of like debugging Visual Studio. Thing is, you're debugging only one single vertex of one single draw call at a time. Okay. Which is always important to remember. You need to pick the correct pixel or the correct vertex where things are breaking. Which can be tricky in its own self. I mean, you have a mesh with, 2000 vertices and which one do you debug? Well, if it's just one triangle that's missing, you have to find that triangle somehow. And that can be hard. But again, nobody said, everything should be easy in these, in this trade of ours, of using D3D.
Yeah, where does that debugging take place in PIX?
Hmm?
When you debug a shader, does it have any PIX or Visual Studio?
It's here in PIX. Basically, it's another tab, a debugger tab in here. You're debugging that particular pixel of this frame, right. Of this draw call, right? So one thing that I should say is you can use this to look at the assembly of the reference shaders. but I will not accept that, of course. You can't just copy and paste. I want HLSL and I want it readable, please. So if you are to reverse engineer that, you better convert it to something that, what it's supposed to be. you better convert it to what it's supposed to be. Don't call it like, variables A, B, C, and D, and all the way to Z, and and now I'm multiplying and now I'm adding, and I don't know why, right? The homework is about you learning, not about. But hey, if you reverse engineer that and convert it back into the lighting functions, then fine. more power to you. You did it the hard way. Okay. Okay, I need to get on with lighting, because the homework is about lighting, so you need to learn about it. There. So what I want you to get from this is what lighting is all about, okay? And mostly it is math. It is math carefully designed or carefully laid out to simulate physical events. And this is what we're trying to simulate. Okay? We have some object. And that object has a surface. And we're going to look at this point. Remember, you know, we're rendering a mesh. You're rendering the surface of an object. Every pixel that gets rendered, every vertex that gets processed, you know, is part of that surface. Okay? So we're going to look at lighting on only one single point. So we're looking at it from a certain direction. So we're going to call this V, which is a view direction. Okay? We're looking at it from here. We have a bunch of light sources, things that are casting light in our world, our 3D world. So those things are emitting some sort of light. That hits this point. And this here is the direction that the light is coming from. There are going to be some light sources that are not light sources per se. It's just light that gets reflected somewhere. And by that, I don't just mean mirrors like in there. Okay? When I am here, I get light from the wall. Hitting my face and changing the appearance of my face. Okay? So that's one of the effects that happen. There is sometimes light that gets through solid matter, okay, that gets through the object from the underside. If you've ever put a flashlight on one side of your hand, you'll see red on the other side because the light actually goes through. Skin and flesh are actually partially transparent. So, but as far as this point is concerned, it just knows that there is light coming from this direction, from some direction, you know, that's underneath, coming from inside of the object, okay? And it sees some amount of light coming from that direction. And then there is the final wrench in the whole caboodle here, which is blockers. So some of our light sources get blocked by objects. And that creates shadows. Places where light doesn't fall because something occludes the light. Okay, the shadow is not something per se, it's just the absence of something. The absence of that light.
Where does the old TV represent something that...
It's, yeah, just emitting light. Whatever light, you know, there's the sun, there's like local lights around here, there's, you know, the TV also emits light. You know, you put your face close to a TV and you see your face change color just because the TV is changing color. So we have light emitters, we have light reflectors, and we have light blockers that affect this whole thing. Okay. In the end, we, the observer, are going to see some color. Okay. So we, the observer, are going to see some color coming out of this point. And this is this seal of V. Okay. For other points, we'll see other colors, right? So for this particular point, this is the formula that tells us what the light that this guy sees is, depending on everything else. Now, this formula, I don't want you ever trying to implement it, right? Okay. Integrating on the sphere is not for the faint of heart. And the rest is all just gobbledygook here, Okay. This is good as a frame of thought. Okay. What this represents is this D is the material. It's what this surface does to all this light that hits it. Particularly what it does with, to all these lights that hit it when seen from this direction. If you have, if that surface were a mirror, then maybe I would see a lot of this and none of that. Okay. If this surface is not a mirror, then maybe I see some of that and some of that and some of that and some of everything. Okay.
So basically you're saying it's a function of the light, the incident angle it's coming in, the vector that it's going to the eye, integrated all...
Yeah, basically it's a function of all the lights that come in, how much light it comes in, from where, and where I'm looking from. Okay? So, light from every direction, you know, reaches here in a different way. From the, you know, through this point. And what that thing is saying is, from everywhere, sum it all together, add it all together. This integral means add everything together. Okay? And this is what you end up with. Okay?
Letter I
represented this? I is these vectors. This I vectors. Okay? You know, if you know math, you know, this DI means that the sphere, you know, is, the I is going through the entire sphere. That's what it means. So it's this I and that I and that I and that and this one 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 and all of them. You know. Added together. The V is just the observer, so it's the same for all, you know, in all cases. When we are rendering from here, we're only interested in the light that ends up here, not the light that ends up elsewhere. Although this function, the D function, the material, is able to compute that. But, you know, as for the purpose of the summation, it's constant. Right.
So if you're doing stereo vision, you could have...
you would have two different viewpoints.
VL, VR, or whatever.
Yeah. Okay. And of course, you know, in games, the camera moves around, so suddenly the V changes from frame to frame. But, okay? So, this is just concept, okay? This is to try to awake you to all the things that affect lighting here. And this function can be as complicated as you can imagine. Okay? There are very simple materials, like the surface of this table. Reasonably simple material. And there are very complex materials. You know, like the reflector panels on the back of your car. Okay? That's a complex material. Or the surface of a DVD. This thing reflects light in a very strange way. Okay, that's a complex material. Okay?
So if I googled lighting equations, would I get hits from lots of different
yeah. So we never ever use that. Don't ever try. You know, it's like trying to simulate something using the wave formula by itself, you know, which is horrendous. You always use approximations. Okay. Which approximation depends on the situation, on exactly what you want to accomplish, right? So never try to use the full thing. I mean, never try to do the perfect light calculation. Yes?
Is that only at runtime? Like, would you use the equation if you're
Yes. Yes, I mean, that's a lighting calculation, so you can use it for anything. If you try to do radiosity, it has its foundation on that. If you try to do a photon mapping, it has its foundation on that. if you use just regular Lambert diffuse formula, then it has its foundation on that. You know, there are different approaches to it. And yes, it can be used offline to calculate lights that never change as you play a game, or you can use them online, you know, at runtime. For lights that do change as you play the game. So there are two concepts here. The concept of light sources, which we're going to use, and the concept of lighting models. And they're orthogonal. Okay? You can have many light sources, and each one of those can have any combination of light models. Or rather, you can have many light sources, if you want it to be physically correct. You can have multiple light sources, which basically express how a light source puts out light around it. And you can have multiple lighting models, which reflects how a material reflects that light into the observer's eye. And I say models because, well, it's better to divide and conquer than to try to use horrendously complicated formulas. So we'll see that typically, you know, for the simple type of rendering, and especially for the homework, you know, there are only two light models that matter. And they're both applicable to any surface. And their contributions are just added together to make for a more complex lighting model. So the contribution of multiple models are added together, and also the contributions of multiple light sources are added together. And they all form a matrix, right? So for each light source, you're going to have to calculate its contribution on each of the models. So the classic models are the Lambert diffuse model and the Phong reflective model. So Lambert is used to model things that are not reflective. Things like mostly the tables, or like briefcase, you know, that briefcase over there. Things that do not reflect light, that do not act like mirrors. And it says that the lighting contribution is just the dot product of the normal at the surface with the direction of the light. So if we have this surface, okay, with this normal, and the light is coming from this direction, then what the observer says, and it doesn't matter from which direction, the V is not here, okay? You can look at it from any angle, and it looks always exactly the same. The contribution is the dot product of those two. If the light hits the surface dead on, then it has full effect on the surface. And what you see is something that is well lit. If the light is coming at an angle, you see it darker. Yes?
Do you chop it off if the dot product is negative?
Yeah, if the dot product is negative, means that the light is coming from here. And in that case, the model assumes that the light is not at all visible here. This is the dark side of the object from that light's point of view. So yeah, we do clip it. All the negative numbers, we clip them to zero.
So this is a non-transparent, non-translucent.
Non-translucent, non-transparent, nothing funny. It's the simplest thing ever in the entire whole world. Okay? You do that to your models and they come alive. Okay? The only thing you need is the normals on the mesh. And you will always need the normals for lighting. Okay? The Phong specular lighting model, basically what it says is that the light contribution, this I here is light intensity. Maybe I should have chosen another letter or something. Kind of confusing with the first formula. Anyway, hopefully we can adjust. So the light intensity is the dot product of the reflection vector of the light. And by reflection, I mean, if this is the light direction, the light is coming from here, the reflected vector is going to be that one. And it's reflected around the normal, right? So this is the light, you know, this is the direction in which the light is going to go if this is a perfect mirror. Okay? You calculate it like this. Always, of course, assuming that the L and the R are both aiming outwards from the model. You know, it's very easy to flip them by mistake, these vectors. Okay? We do the calculation like that because it's easier to print with all the vectors coming out of the point on the surface. So what this is if my viewer is here, so this is also the view direction, okay, the dot product between those two is going to be a 1, right? So I'm going to see all the reflected light reflected on the surface, okay? If my viewer is not here, if my viewer is here, say, so this is V, okay, the dot product between those two is going to be, well, not 1, much less than 1. Which means that the viewer is not going to see any reflection on the surface. This is the main point of this formula here. Okay? This power basically indicates if the viewpoint is not directly on this reflection direction, if it's kind of close but not quite, when this power is lower, okay, it's going to make that dot product bigger. So it increases the amount of directions that are going to be seeing any reflection from this light. So you would use a very, very high number for a mirror. Because in a mirror, on any specific point, you only see a light reflected, you know, if it's perfectly reflected, with no deviation. When you decrease that number, it blurs the reflection, makes it fuzzier. Okay. If a light is bouncing off a surface, the blob that represents that light gets bigger. Okay. That's that. The Lambert's diffuse model doesn't change at all with the direction of with the position of the viewer. The reflection is very, very much affected by the position of the viewer. There are two very, very different effects that happen on surfaces of objects. And we just compute them and then add them together. Yes?
Could R dot V be negative? In that case, you just drop it?
Yeah. That means, you know, it's more than 90 degrees away. It's just, no. Again, these are all just approximations of real materials, what real materials do. With these two, you can render things that look okay. Pretty well okay. Where did I leave these? Okay. Those were the surface models, you know, the lighting models. As for the light sources, you know, basically for the light sources, you need to have something like, you know, where they are in the world, you know, where the light is coming from to objects, which is this L, and also how much light they're outputting, and how much in the red, green, and blue channels, which means, you know, lights do have color. Okay. You can have green light that only output, you know, only sends out green. Right? There is another model, which is the ambient light. Ambient light represents the light that comes from places where there doesn't seem to be any light that hits them. For instance, I am looking right now, I'm looking at this, at the backside, you know, of this little mouse, and I see stuff. So there must be light hitting it that's not coming from there, but all the lights are there, right? I guess there's the screen, maybe there's that, you know, but the thing is, it's very hard to model those things. So what we do is we say, hey, you know, there's light going from everywhere to everywhere. And that's an approximation. With a certain intensity. And that's the ambient light. Okay? And it's that light that you have to do no calculations with at all. You just add it to everything else. Its general characteristic is kind of like diffuse light. It does not depend on the viewer at all. It does not depend on the position of the viewer. I mean, that is like diffuse. Questions so far? Okay. Then there is a directional light, you know, which just has the intensity and some direction. And that direction is constant everywhere. It's used to model the sun. Because the sun comes to, you know, comes to the earth always from the same direction. Right? Sunlight. And it's the simplest. You know, the light source provides the light vector already. There's no need to calculate it. And then just the intensity. And you can apply Lambert and Phong to it. You can calculate diffuse and specular. And then there are more models like point lights and spot lights. Okay. Point lights are lights that radiate from one point everywhere, like a light bulb. That's what they model. And then spotlight is more like a flashlight that radiates in one direction with a certain cone of influence. And again, it's just light models. Both point and spotlight, for instance, you know, they don't have a specific direction, but they have a specific point where the light comes from. Okay. So you need to use that and the position at which you're calculating the light, the position of the surface, and subtract and normalize in order to get the light vector. And then each one of those puts a modifier to the intensity depending on distance. If you're far away from the light, you don't get much. If you're close to the light, you get a lot. That's a little more up for grabs. The attenuation, as far as defined by the fixed function pipeline in Dirac 3D, is a quadratic formula. So basically, what it means is there is an A0, A1, and A2. You know, three values that determine how, you know, what the intensity of the light is depending on distance. Okay.
It could be inverse squared.
Yeah. So they are applied like that. D is the distance between the light and the point on the surface. Okay, when you normalize that vector, you know, you also keep the magnitude around. In order to do this. Okay. And the actual intensity is those components divided by that attenuation. But that's just a formula. It's a way of specifying this. You could think of any other linear, you know, cubic, because you want more detail or something. The real physical one is quadratic, like this. Just divided by distance squared. The rest is just because, for artistic purposes, it actually looks better for some reason. Just because the rest is all hackery and cheating and lying. It's approximating a complex formula with something very simple. Yeah.
Do surfaces have a reflectivity, like a shine of white light on a red surface, or is it just defined by some kind of pixel shader thing?
Yeah. Okay, so when you talk about pixel shader, you know, then it has whatever you put in it. Okay, and here I'm talking about one pair of simple models that have been used for many, many, many years. And they are the ones that the fixed function lighting engine in Direct3D implements. Okay. There are things like this P, this power, reflective power, which are a factor of the surface. So they're part of the material. Okay. There's another thing is materials can have colors, right? Like, this is blue. It doesn't matter if I shine red light at it, you know. It is blue, right? It's a property of the material. You know, you just multiply that color by this. But not by this. Why?
The material is blue, but it's not.
Yeah, typically when you have a reflection, like if you crouch in front of the table a little bit, you'll see that it actually reflects light. Okay? And also in here, you will see, I don't know if you can see it very well, you probably can't. But basically when you see a shine on a surface, the shine obscures the color of the surface. Okay, the reflectivity overlaps the color of the surface. It doesn't blend with it. Diffuse light blends with the color of the surface. Reflections completely obscure it with white or with the color of the light. I could shine a green light on a red object that has no reflectivity, and I would see it black. Because the light is only green, and the object is only red. And green and red do not mix. You know, I put in green and, you know, I can't get red to come out.
Theoretically, the object is absorbing all of the red.
Yeah. That's, when you think about the physics, that's exactly what happens. When you see a red object, it's because it absorbs blue and green light. It only reflects the red. You know, it only emits, you know, let's pass the red. So if you don't give it red, then it's black.
Has there been any direction in adding more color channels? I've heard of a TV that supposedly has a yellow channel as well as the standard.
Yeah, TV. I mean, ultimately, color is a spectrum, right? You know, it's like you have multiple frequencies and you have certain intensities at different frequencies, and that's a color. Okay. Ultimately, what we have is red, green, and blue, right? And we modulate those, and they overlap, right? I mean, they're not pure, you know, single frequency light. You know, it's a range around the red, a range around the green, and so on. So we modulate this up and down, we modulate this up and down, and we modulate this up and down, and kind of simulates more or less a spectral profile. Of course, it cannot simulate every single spectra profile. It is an approximation, like everything else. But our eyes, they like those colors. They can't really tell this one, okay? It tells this one because it gets some of this and some of that, okay? Because our receptors in our eyes are also imprecise. Yeah. So green, red, and blue are the perfect for us. If aliens come to Earth, they look at TV and they might say, "Why is it black and white? Why does it have no color?"
Or dogs, they just have, I think, blue and green.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, just what can I say? Things are built for us in this Earth because we built them. Everything is an approximation there. But
yeah, if you wanted to do for ease, you have to add UV.
If you're a daltonic, then you know your mix is different. And there are things that you can see that I can't if you're a daltonic.
Mathematically, for the diffuse lighting, do you multiply the color of the light times the color of the
surface? Yeah. Yeah, so basically this is the intensity of the light. You multiply it by the color of the light to see the intensity on the three channels, you know, which will be different because a red light doesn't have any green anyway. And then because it's being bounced on the surface, you multiply it by the color of the surface. If you see that the vertex shader outputs diffuse and specular separately instead of adding them together, it's because the color of the surface is given by the texture. And we don't know the color of the surface until the pixel shader. So the vertex shader might calculate the diffuse and the specular, but it keeps them separate because the pixel shader has to multiply the texture to the diffuse before adding the specular. Okay? But this is basically the secret of lighting. You have in D3D for fixed function, you have the D3D light structure, and it has all these parameters. You know, these are all, and it has parameters like ambient. You know, what does it mean for a point light to have an ambient component? I don't know. But they added it for some reason. Okay. Basically, it's saying, hey, you know, if this light is active, it means, you know, there's more ambient everywhere. You know, that's basically what it means. So it's more added to the ambient, you know, if the light is on. Why does it have different colors for diffuse and specular? This is a light source. The light source only has one color. You know, it emits light of one color and it goes. You know, what does it have separate there? I don't know. I mean, it's all, why not? You know, let's just add parameters and, you know, multiply different color to each one of them. And maybe for artistic purposes, you know, it'll be better. Yeah, that's it for Direct3D. Okay, I didn't replicate this entirely on the shaders there because it's just silly. Okay, it's just silly. But hey, you know, maybe some artists out there can do good things with it. What does it mean for a light color to be negative? Those are floats. They can be negative. What happens if the light is negative? It's like the light is not emitting light, it's sucking light out of the, you know, it's like black hole, right? Well, you know, artists have used that actually for good purpose. Because, you know, they have a level and they lay a couple of lights and then the math says that there's a lot of light in this corner, but they say, no, it looks better when it's darker over here. So they put a black light over there. Okay? Yeah. Yeah, it's basically saying, hey, you know, I don't want this to be so lit, but I want the rest to be lit, so there you go. I'm going to put a, you know, shadow, you know, like a dark spot in the level. Okay. And it has been done. Yeah. So exactly. You know, if you think about it from the physical point of view, it doesn't make sense. But if you don't think about it too much, you know, maybe it adds to the mood and ambience of the game. I don't know. And hey, if it makes the game better, it is good. Even if it's physically incorrect, and blatantly inaccurate. Ultimately, you know, the good of the game is the ultimate good. When we're developing a game, at least. So in here you have this stuff, the fall off and the theta and pi and phi are for spotlights. They indicate what happens in that cone of light. You know, there's like, you know, more light in the middle and less light towards the edges of the cone and so on. I'm not going to bore you with the details, okay? You can look up the documentation, you can look up formulas. It doesn't have anything to do with the homework. There's no spotlight there. So there's one point that's kind of interesting, which is emissive light. Okay, emissive light is light that doesn't come from the environment. It comes from the model itself, from the surface. You could add a component to your vertices saying emissive light, and you can make one part of your model be glowing, exactly. Glowy eyes. You know, that's perfect for it. For instance. Okay. Or if you're doing a Tron game, then all those, you know, light lines on the surface of the models, you know, those can be done with emissive light. Meaning, it doesn't matter if there is no light in the universe. You know, that thing is actually going to be visible, no matter what. And what it is, it's just a color that gets added. You know, just because I'm the surface, I'm adding color. There is no light coming in, but light does come out anyway. Okay, just add it. Okay. So, the pixel shader is involved a little bit in the light calculations. It's mostly involved in getting the texture involved in the lighting calculations. Of course, you can choose to do all lighting in a pixel shader and it'll look better and so on and so forth, but even when it's not, when all the lighting calculations are done in the vertex shader, you know, the pixel shader is still a little bit involved just because of that. Okay. In Direct3D, you have the structure for the fixed function. Okay, when you do lighting, you have this function, which is the material. And it says, oh, what the diffuse and ambient specular and emissive properties of the surface are. Okay. There are four corresponding render states with which you can set the material color source for each one of the four types of colors. Okay? So you can say, hey, you know, I'm going to take the diffuse from my vertices, the ambient from render states, you know, from the ambient from the material, and specular and emissive also from the material. Or I'm going to take diffuse and emissive from the vertices and the other two from this material structure. Okay. So this thing just selects each one of the four where it needs to come from. Okay. That's fixed function. I'm not going to go into any more detail. When you're doing shaders, that all goes out the window. And whatever you do in the shader is what goes. So this is what's called the fixed function pipeline. It's been there for many, many years. And if you ever get to do Direct3D 10, you know, this is not there at all. There's only exclusively shaders in D3D 10 and above.
Does it come with some pre-compiled shaders?
Pre-compiled? No.
Oh, not, I mean, some shaders that they provide for you.
Nope. Yeah. There's XNA4, for instance, if you ever get a chance to use that, does. XNA4 does have, five different shader pairs, you know, basically effects. And there's a typical one that implements all of this, And there's another one that's used for things like light maps, and there's another one that's used for alpha testing, you know, which we haven't talked about yet much. But, you know, you can use it for like fences or leaves or things that you want to cut out with detail, but you don't want to spend much on it. So yeah, it's got several. And you know, the sources of those are out there, and they're basically Direct3D 9 effect files. So the shaders in there, you can grab them if you want. You know, it's maybe one way. When you're doing homework, I don't think I've mentioned this, at least not loud enough. I'm perfectly okay with you using any materials that you want, anything that you can find. Just, if you're going to grab code from somewhere, make sure to mention it. You know, it's not nice to just copy and shut up. Same as, you know, I completely encourage you to talk and to ask each other questions and everything. Just don't give your code to somebody else. You know, just don't give somebody else the solution. But, you know, feel free to talk and to actually provide help with it. And I will, of course, in the mailing list if anybody asks questions there. Okay. This has gone a little longer than I expected. Maybe because of that couple crashes. See, I have the Xbox here, and I wasn't... you know, I don't think we have time to do anything with it. Which is a little wrong, but, you know, are there any more questions about this stuff? I mean, this stuff is important because of the homework.
So for homework 3, we're just rendering a pixel shader or a texture shader?
I'm giving you this. This is a pixel shader. Simple as it gets. Okay, it has two inputs, the diffuse and specular colors. And it needs to output the correct color. Filling the, you know, right now I'm just outputting green. Substitute this with the right thing. Okay. Shouldn't be difficult. Okay. Same thing with this one. This one does the same thing, but also supports one texture. So it gets texture coordinates, and you need to do the right thing. Again, simple. This is the complex one. It's got a whole bunch of parameters. These are like material and light information. These are the inputs. These are the outputs. Okay. You can feel free to ignore completely this tangent thing. I'll be using this little sample a little bit, you know, to explain some finer points of other ways of lighting, of doing lighting. I've already added here the multiplication by the worldview position, worldview projection matrix. Wow, that's an opportunity. And then also the transformation of the position and the normal into the lighting space. Now, this is probably redundant. In this case, it is redundant, but it's one idea. Okay, if you are going to do lighting in any specific space, you could always provide the matrix that transforms the positions and the normals to that space directly. Okay, instead of saying, oh, it's going to be world space. And here is whatever the color of this shader decides it is. And it could be any space. So what this does is just transform the inputs into that space. And then it does nothing. It says, oh, diffuse is just the input. Okay. And specular is zero, and texture coordinates. I'm copying them because that's so easy that I didn't want to like just leave it to you. And then in here I'm calculating fog because we're not talking about it today. I just put in the formula there. Okay.
So on this one, the only code we need to do is if you scroll back up, where light can't be as you go here.
Yep. This is what you need to substitute with the right thing. Okay. And in order to do it, you have to use all of these constants, which indicate indicate where the camera position is, what the ambient color is. Well, there's one directional light and one point light. So the directional light has a color and a direction. And the point light has a color and a position. And the attenuation. Okay. And this is just the three, A0, A1, A2, like I put over there. And then in here, there's the specular power and some data for the fog. And here, there's a specular factor. And this is used in the program to disable specular. So you just multiply whatever specular ends up by this. Okay, that's all. So you have those things. You need to make it look good. Okay, I showed you what it looks like. You need to make it look good. You have to put the lighting formulas in there, Lambert and Fong. Now, for the basic assignment, directional light, Lambert, that's it. Okay, you need to get that one right. And that will make a lot of difference. And then, you add the point light and you add the specular, and that'll give you extra credit. And also, I suggested for extra credit to add a shader somewhere in your game. Now, that will require you figuring out how to compile the shader, how to load it up, all those things. Okay? There are plenty of samples out there, and if you have any doubts at all, just ask on the list. And we'll talk about it.
I assume the solution or project you gave us has the build commands for these VFX files. Is that correct?
No.
No?
No. Once you get the solution for this, yes, you'll have everything. This thing does two things. First, it has embedded all those shaders. The good version, it has them inside of this executable. And they're actually compiled as part of the build process in Visual Studio. And then it looks in the directory where the executable is for those three files. And if it encounters them, it compiles them. If it encounters any errors, you'll find out what happens. basically, you'll get those errors. And if it compiles them without errors, then it uses them instead of the embedded ones. So one thing that you can do, if you want, is, I'm going to implement this one shader. Okay, so you can remove the other two. Okay, so they don't get loaded. And the executable will just use the reference one for those other two. You can modify that one shader until it looks good, and then, bring in another one. Okay.
Oh, sorry, one more question. I thought there was two pixel shaders? Or I saw two different pixel shades.
Yeah, there are two pixel shaders. I just showed you the two. One of them is without texture, the other one is with texture. The one without texture is being used for the ground. The one with texture is used for everything else. But I mean, you can see it. It's magenta and green, right? So they're very easy to distinguish. Another thing that might not be clear from all this, and apologize for that, is the whole fog thing, is not handled by the pixel shader. the fog is applied as a fixed function after the pixel shader. So you don't have to do it there. So. Good night. See you next week. Remember to sign in if you haven't.
Some people left already.
Yeah, well, I hope they did.